So if you have a Bible, I'll ask you to open to Ezekiel 36. Ezekiel 36, we're going to be there in just a few minutes. Just to save time, though, I'll ask you to turn there now while we're getting set up here. Good to be with you again. I always appreciate speaking to this congregation. I speak also at times at Temple Terrace, but speaking for you is different, obviously because of my background here. And most of you have known me since I was very, very little skinny, scrawny kid. Now you're seeing me become a little heftier of an individual. But I always appreciate being able to speak to you. It is definitely something that I enjoy. And I hope the words which I have to say this morning will be encouraging to you. I want to talk to you this morning about something that I think is very important. And I hope after I'm done speaking about it, you'll think it's very important if you don't already. And that's how we as Christians can do things that actually hinder the gospel message from being spread to those that are unbelievers. And I want to talk this morning, certainly it's not going to be an exhaustive discussion, because there's a lot of things we could talk about that I think that we as human beings can do to hinder the message of God. But I do want to talk about just a few things that I've chosen, and I want to stress to you, I'm not speaking to you about these things as someone who has mastered these. I'm speaking about things I think all of us struggle with, all of us have to be careful of, and I think it's important for us to recognize what they are, so that we can encourage each other to make sure we don't fall into these traps. Before discussing the things that I want to discuss about how we hinder the gospel, I want to first make sure we're on the same page about why this topic is such a weighty topic to be discussed. To understand how serious this is, we have to understand this theological concept that God has chosen to attach His name to us as His people. How has God chosen to reveal Himself to all the nations? Yes, He's given us His Son. He's taken on flesh, become a human being, and revealed Himself that way. And yes, He's given us the revealed Word of God. But how has God chosen to spread the knowledge of His Son and the knowledge of that Word to all of those that maybe weren't there in the first century to see Jesus? None of us, I'm assuming, became a Christian because we had some personal revelation from God. He appeared to us personally. And He showed us, manifested Himself to us personally or to me personally. And so I became a Christian because I had this, I met God. I had this vision of Him, or He appeared to me in a dream. God could have done it that way, but that's not how He's chosen to do it. All of us in this room who have become Christians only became Christians because another human being who wore the name of God spoke to us about God and showed us what God was like through them, through their lifestyles and through their teaching. That's how God's chosen to do it. And that's always been His primary method of revelation with His people Israel. Remember these words that Moses spoke in Deuteronomy. Yahweh will establish you as a people holy to Himself as He has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments of Yahweh your God and walk in His ways. And all the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of Yahweh. The nations around Israel were supposed to have come to a knowledge of Yahweh because they were supposed to be able to look at Israel, God's people, and see God. I mean, the Israelites' holy lifestyle, their righteousness, their honesty, their love, all of that was supposed to point to Yahweh being the one true God of heaven and earth. Not Baal, not Molech, not these other deities that they worshipped. That was God's plan. And Israel's failure to do that is something that the prophet Ezekiel mentions in Ezekiel 36. I asked you to turn there just a few minutes ago. If you have your Bibles, look at Ezekiel 36 with me in verses 19 to 21. Because Israel failed to do this. Speaking of Israel's unrighteousness and their failure to do this, starting in verse 19, God says, because of Israel's unrighteousness, I scattered them among the nations, and they were dispersed through the countries. In accordance with their ways and their deeds, I judged them. But when they came to the nations, wherever they came, they profaned my holy name, in that people said of them, these are the people of Yahweh. And yet they had to go out of His land. But I had concern for my holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations to which they had come. Israel's sin, their sinful lifestyles, their choice to not live according to the righteous and holy lifestyle that Yahweh had commanded them, and the ultimate judgment that God had then as a righteous judge to mete out on his unrighteous people, all of that caused Israel to have the complete opposite effect they were supposed to have. And instead of causing nations to look to Israel and to look to their God Yahweh and say, this is a holy God. Look at this God they worship. Look at the actions of this great and holy people. Instead of that, Israel's actions caused Yahweh's holy name to be profaned. And what we see in Ezekiel is that is not a minor offense. That is not something that God is just going to let slide. That is something that if his people cause his name to be profaned, that is something that God shows us in Ezekiel. You're answering to me for that one when I meet you face to face. This is serious. And that's why the passages in the New Testament with Christ's church, the new Israel, that's why the passages about how we Christians are supposed to conduct ourselves is so important. I know you recognize these words from 1 Peter 2, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Just as with Israel, God's plan hasn't changed. He is still expecting himself to be glorified through the people he's attached his name to. And so, even for us Christians, how are unbelievers going to come to glorify God? Well, Peter tells us it's through your conduct. Those of you who are wearing the name of Christ, who are wearing God's name, it is through your actions that the knowledge of God is supposed to spread and bring glory to the Father. And so I think the seriousness of this topic and of this responsibility for us as Christians cannot be overstated. When we call ourselves Christians, which means follower of Christ, we're accepting a great honor that God has bestowed upon us. But it is also a tremendous responsibility, because our actions have direct influence on how other people are going to think of God and are going to think of Christ and are going to think of Christ's church. It's our actions that are going to have an effect, a direct influence on that. We will either help others to know God or we will hinder the process, because of how we choose to act while still claiming that we belong to God. And I think, as we've seen in Ezekiel, that if we cause God's name to be profaned, that is going to be a serious offense that we do not want to have on our record when we meet him in judgment. And so with all of that in mind, just with all that in mind about how important I think this is for us to recognize, I want to talk about just a few things that I think, a few common traps that we can fall into that I think do indeed hinder this process and that we ought not to be doing, because it does put a hindrance on what we're supposed to be doing and carrying the name of God to other people. I believe that we can hinder the gospel of Christians by staying silent. This is an insidious way, in my opinion, an insidious way that we as Christians can hinder the gospel message from being spread. Do your peers even know you're a Christian? Those that you work with, those who go to school with you, your fellow students? When our coworkers challenge God's authority, say, over sexuality, or they make challenges about God's authority over some other matter of life, or they mock Christians, if we stay silent in those moments, whose cause are we aiding? Yahweh's or Satan's? Which one's happier about our silence in those moments? You remember what the apostle's words were in Ephesians when he said, "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them, for it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret." As we live in a culture that continually mocks Christians, and a culture that continually refuses to accept any objective moral authority, it does become hard, admittedly. It becomes hard for us to speak up in those moments because we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to maybe bring attention to ourselves, or we don't want to hurt someone's feelings and offend someone. And so it's so easy for us to just, and I'm not saying, we'll just stay silent. But if we look at what Paul says here, non-participation in those sinful acts isn't enough. Paul doesn't say, take no part in the unfruitful works and you're good. Paul says, we're supposed to expose them. We're supposed to speak up as Christians, and we're supposed to make known to people, hey, I don't think that's right. And get them to think about it. That's our part of our responsibility. I'd submit to you that a silent Christian is an oxymoron. That there's no such thing in the Bible as a silent Christian. They don't go together. Being silent completely betrays the whole point of being a Christian. I think Jesus' words in Luke, which I know are familiar to you, carry a frightening implication for this topic we're talking about. I tell you, everyone who acknowledges me before men, the Son of Man also will acknowledge before the angels of God. But the one who denies me before men will be denied before the angels of God. I don't think Jesus is just meaning here, denying me in that you verbally say out loud, I don't think Jesus is the Christ. I don't think Jesus is the Son of God. Doesn't our silence, isn't that also included in here? I mean, when I'm at work, and some people at work are talking, you know, in the break room, whatever, and they're talking about the issue of gay marriage, and pretty much their consensus, which no doubt will probably be in your workplace too, because it's the common American consensus, is that, well, I don't like what they're doing, because I'm not gay, but if they want to do that, that's their business, and so, hey, I mean, who am I to say anything about it? And if I've got an opportunity to give another point of view, a biblical point of view, and to get them thinking about a higher moral authority, if I choose to stay silent in that moment, am I not denying Jesus? Is that not a denial of His lordship over my life and His lordship over His creation? Or, you know, when you're at school and your friends come up and they're like, oh, last weekend I got so drunk. I was so hungover on Saturday, and they're bragging about it. And, you know, and as a teenager, the easiest thing to do, because it's so hard as a teenager, you want to fit in. But even if you're not a teenager, if you're an adult, and you just kind of laugh with them, you're just like, yeah, all right. And you don't say anything about it. Is that not a denial of Jesus just as much as Peter in the courtyard? If we're not willing to stand up and say, hey, I don't think that's right. I mean, I think you should think about that. Think about your actions. We've got to be able to speak up and take initiative about these things. I think Jesus' words here are frightening. When you understand what Jesus is saying, if we're going to be silent and just going to be ashamed to ever speak up about Christianity, well, what makes us think He's going to be proud of us and want to speak up for us on that day of judgment? I think this is an insidious way that Satan has gotten Christians to be non-effective in the spread of the gospel. Now, I do want to say this, just so you don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying, and I don't think Paul is saying, nor Jesus is saying, that every single time somebody at work says something unbiblical, we've got to go over to them and say, hey, that's not biblical, and bring it out. I don't think that's what Paul said. I think we have to use our judgment. We have to choose our battles, so to speak, about when we're going to engage in conversation. But what I'm saying is, we can't constantly stay silent under the guise of being prudent. Well, I'm just going to be prudent, and so I'm going to be silent this time. And the next time you're silent. And the next time you're silent. Until now, you're just an ineffective proclaimer of the gospel because you're not proclaiming anything. I think that's the danger that we can fall into. And yes, we have to use our judgment. But I think that if we're ashamed to speak up, we are hindering the gospel message and we're jeopardizing our own souls. I think that we need to think about that and the serious nature of it. Another way I think Christians can hinder the gospel is by living unrighteously. And this one's obvious. And it should be obvious to everybody, but if you're like me, you have met Christians that see no contradiction between an immoral lifestyle and then them saying, oh, I'm a Christian. I mean, I've met some like that just throughout the years in school. It's almost like Christianity is kind of like your political party, where it's like, oh, I'm a Republican. But being a Republican has no effect on how I live my life. And it kind of becomes that way with Christianity. People are like, oh, I'm a Christian. Yeah. But it manifests itself really in no way and how that person lives their lives. And I think that if we do that, it is a serious detriment to convincing anybody that Jesus is the Son of God and that they need to have their sins forgiven. It's an ingenious lie that Satan has fed to people, that people have bought, that you can be one of God's children and still live your life the way you want to. It's ingenious because you get the best of both worlds if you hold to that worldview. We've seen how God has chosen to reveal himself through the righteous lives of his people. It's what Jesus was getting at with these familiar words. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. And again, we see Jesus' emphasis here. The knowledge of the Father in heaven is going to come through you. It's going to come through your actions, my disciples. That's how people are going to know God, how they're going to come to know the true creator of heaven and earth. I don't think any of us here became a Christian because someone came and spoke to us about God on Friday and spoke to us about Jesus on Friday. And then on Monday, they came to us and said, man, you won't believe who I slept with last weekend. I mean, which one of us was brought to Christ in that way? Or which one of us was brought to Christ in a way where someone comes and talks to us about Christ one day and then the next week is talking about how drunk they got or what pornography they were able to watch or any of those things, even the language that they speak? I mean, who became a Christian because this person's telling us about Christ and then the profanity, their speech is laced with profanity? None of us came to know Christ that way. But yet it's so easy for us to kind of take the emphasis off ourselves and think, well, what I'm doing is not really that big of a deal. But how can we possibly expect somebody to find appeal in the Christian lifestyle if, from their vantage point, the only difference between what they're doing and what we're doing is that we have to wake up early on Sunday to go to church? I mean, if that's the only difference between me and you Christians, I'm going to stay not a Christian because I don't want to wake up on Sunday to go to church. Thank you very much. I mean, there's so much more to it. And if we're not living righteously in a way where our lives are backing up the name of Christ that we're choosing to wear publicly, then we are a serious hindrance to the gospel message. A serious hindrance. And Jesus says here that if that happens, we're not good for anything except to be thrown out. I mean, again, Jesus is blunt. He's telling us like it is. I mean, this is not all those who get into heaven with a C or above average. I mean, you either do it or you don't. It's two extremes. You're either letting your light shine or you're not. And if you're not, Jesus says, you'll be cast out. I hope that we examine ourselves to make sure that the example and the decisions that we're making outside of these walls, amidst our coworkers and amidst our fellow students, or whoever your peers are, family members, whoever, I hope that we examine ourselves to make sure that the decisions that we're making are going to back up that holy name of Yahweh that we're choosing to say that, oh yeah, we wear that name. And we wear it with pride. I hope we live that claim. Because again, that's how all of us became Christians. I wouldn't have become a Christian if my parents were telling me about God and then my parents were going out and doing all these things that contradicted the very things they were trying to teach me. I wouldn't have become a Christian. But I had great examples in that. That's why I became a Christian, because I saw for myself what it's like to have these principles and to have somebody tell me, look, this is the truth. There's a creator. He wants us to live holy lives. And then I got to see it manifested in the family that I had. That's why I became a Christian. We can't expect anybody to become a Christian if we're not going to live what we proclaim. And one final thing I want to talk about very quickly about how I think we hinder the gospel. Because I think we hinder the gospel by giving bad answers to good questions. If we're not silent in our Christianity, about our Christianity, and if we are living our lives righteously and people see that, it's inevitable at some point we're going to be in a conversation with someone, or someone's going to even come up to us and ask us some question that either they're struggling with or maybe have some objection to Christianity. Like, hey, you call yourself a Christian? Well, tell me this. How come? And then fill in the blank. One of the things that we need to equip ourselves to do is to be able to deal with those questions and be able to answer those questions in a way that is thoughtful. I have seen and met Christians that have chosen to remain unequipped to be able to deal with these types of questions that unbelievers will bring to them. And I say remain unequipped because it's a choice that they made. They choose not to really think about things outside of, you know, just kind of their own bubble. Or they have chosen not to study the scriptures. They don't study them. And so when someone comes to them to ask, or comes to them to ask them a question about something or to defend some part of the gospel, they remain unequipped because they just haven't studied. They haven't studied about it. They haven't thought about some of the issues that are in our culture, like gay marriage or like atheism and all those things now that our culture struggles with. One of the stigmas that especially atheists love to say about Christians is that Christians are uneducated. That really Christianity is really for the uneducated members of our society. Now, obviously, that's not true. But why has that stigma been able to stick? If you watch interviews on YouTube or debates between atheists, and I think part of this is atheists sometimes choose who they're going to debate. They choose those that they know they're not, that the Christian won't be able to meet them intellectually. But still, if you see publicly some Christians who are speaking out about these things, the atheists are right. That person's not very educated. They haven't studied the scriptures well enough to be able to meet the question that's being given to them. And that's something that I think is a serious hindrance to the gospel if we choose to be one of those people. You know, Jesus said this about his servants, "Behold, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." Now, he said this, granted, to the apostles. I don't think this just applies to the apostles. I don't think they were under some stricter standard of seeking of knowledge than we are as his people. And as we've already seen this morning, all of us are tasked with taking the gospel to other people. And so I think absolutely this is applicable to all of us. And it's a responsibility that all of us have. I think, if I'm understanding Jesus correctly here, what I would take from this, you think about it yourself to see if you agree with this interpretation, but what I would take from this is, Jesus doesn't expect nor want his people to be mindless automatons or just kind of blissfully ignorant simpletons. He's expecting his people to use their intelligence that they've been given, to use their reasoning abilities that they've been given, each to their own measure, but to use them in a way that they can better present the intelligence and reason of the gospel. I think that's what Jesus is saying here. We should all be praying for what the psalmist said in Psalm 119. "Teach me good judgment and knowledge, for I believe in your commandments." This is a lifelong process, but I think it's our responsibility. Now, I do want to say one thing to clarify, in case this thought has entered your head, or in case I've done a poor job of saying this to you. I'm not saying that this standard of intellectual prowess is set for us as Christians, and all of us need to meet this standard. Obviously, all of us have different abilities. Not all of us are going to be William Lane Craigs and just have brilliant minds who are able to debate and talk on a level that is far superior to anything I could ever talk about. Not all of us are going to be at that level. But I think what Jesus and the Gospels are saying, what our responsibility is are we pursuing knowledge to the best of our ability, our own individual ability, to be as knowledgeable of an instrument as we each individually can be in order to be a better equipped proclaimer and defender of the gospel among those who are going to ask us questions inevitably if we are indeed living the way we should and if we're not being silent about the gospel. To get better answers, I just want to briefly make three suggestions. These are my own opinion, but I just submit them to you just for you to think about and see if they don't help give you some ideas about how to enhance our responsibility about pursuing knowledge. I think the first and obvious one is we need to study the Bible on our own. I mean, it's amazing to me, again, if your experience is like mine, where you've met Christians, and as you're talking to them, you realize they really don't have a knowledge of the scriptures. They don't really know what Israel was. They don't have a knowledge of things like that. And so I'll challenge you with a question. I mean, when was the last time you opened your Bible to really study? I don't just mean you open it, read a few verses, close it, and you go to sleep. I mean really study it, really reflect on it, and take time to delve into the Word. I think that's something all of us should be doing. And again, all of us have different abilities. We're all going to be able to do that at different levels. But are we just doing it as best as we can to make ourselves as knowledgeable as we can be about the gospel? If you haven't been doing a good job of studying the Bible on your own, I'd encourage you to make it one of your New Year's resolutions. Just, I'm going to study the Bible more this year and really, really study it, really think about it. I think that's something we all should be doing. I think another thing we should be doing to help us give better answers and be better defenders of the gospel is to listen to the arguments of the other side. I saw a lecture the other day from a guy at the, I think it was Berkeley, California, and he was joking. He's not a believer. But he was joking before his lecture about how before he started his lecture, this man came up to him and said, "Hey, Mr. So-and-so, are you going to be denying the Exodus?" Because he was going to be talking about the Exodus. And the guy said, "Are you going to be denying the Exodus? Because if you are, I'm not going. I'm going to the other lecture." And I don't know why the guy, you know, what all of his reasons were. But it seemed to me like he had the attitude that a lot of Christians have where anything outside of a conservative evangelical interpretation, I'm not even going to bother listening to it. But I'll submit to you, brethren, if we do that, and we have a coworker or someone who is convinced by those arguments, are we not making ourselves poorly equipped to be able to talk to them at a thoughtful level about their beliefs if we ourselves refuse to even think about anything that's outside of a biblical point of view? I mean, if I want to be a better defender against atheism, I need to know about atheism. I need to know what arguments have convinced people that there is no God so that I can be a better instrument in talking to those people and dealing with the arguments they've been convinced by. We don't need to be afraid of other perspectives. As my dad used to say, and I'm sure many of you will remember what he said, the truth will always win out. You don't have to be scared to watch a lecture where this man is denying God, denying there's an existence of God, or reading a book by an atheist, or listening to people who are saying, look, here's why gay marriage is okay, and really listening to it so we can think about the arguments that they find convincing and then take them to the scriptures and make ourselves a better defender against those arguments. I'd suggest to you that this is something we should be doing, and I'd suggest to you that if we just kind of keep our heads in the sand and don't give any thought to the other side, we're not really equipping ourselves to be very good instruments when it comes to dealing with those people who are convinced by these very arguments. I'll give you one final suggestion that I just think is crucial, in my opinion, is that, and this is a little more wordy, obviously, I'm quoting from a book here, which I'll quote from in just a minute. We need to recognize that the biblical text is a cultural artifact emerging from an ancient context. In my opinion, again, you think about it whether you agree with this or not. In my opinion, one of the biggest mistakes that Christians make when they're dealing with someone who is a knowledgeable atheist or someone who's been convinced by this Bible being nothing more than just ancient myths or something, one of the biggest mistakes that I think we can make is treating these 66 ancient documents as if they're just written in a vacuum. I think we have to remember and treat these as we study them, that these documents were written to a particular people, in a particular culture, in a particular time period. The book that I'm quoting from here is from this book. Professor John Walton is professor at Wheaton College of Old Testament. And he says this in his book, I think he's exactly right. If we do not bring the information from the ancient cognitive environment to bear on the text, we will automatically impose the parameters of our worldview, thus risking serious distortion of meaning. I think he's exactly right. One of the biggest offenders in this area is the atheist Richard Dawkins. He's the one who wrote the book, The God Delusion. And if you've seen him in interviews, he does this all the time. It drives me nuts. Because he'll take and criticize things in the Bible, but he'll criticize them by interpreting it as a 21st century American, as if it was written in 21st century America. He gives no credence or no thought to the fact that this was written in the ancient Near East to people with certain cultural values. Certain things were done culturally at that time that are very different from today. He doesn't give any credence to that. And it allows him to make criticisms that wouldn't be valid if he was just interpreting these the same way I'm sure he interprets other ancient documents like Herodotus' histories. You can't read that and then just think, oh, well, everything they did in ancient Greece is just like they do in America, and then just judge them by that standard. You can't do that. And when Richard Dawkins debates Christians, I've seen Christians who do the same thing, right back to him, because they themselves have ignored this concept. They have ignored this part of Bible study, that these are written in a particular culture and written in a particular time period. And I think that if we do this, we are severely hampering our ability, first of all, to understand the text, but then second, to be able to meet some of these arguments in a way that makes them think about it, probably in a way they've never thought about it before. and it will alleviate some of the criticisms that are leveled against the Scriptures. Well, these three things I've spoken about this morning, they're not the only three things we could have spoken about. But I think these three things are things that we as Christians can do to hinder the gospel message. And I hope, and my goal has been, to talk about these things, to bring them to our attention, not because I feel like this congregation is guilty of these, I'm targeting Barico, just because I think all Christians struggle with these. I mean, we all struggle with staying silent and being good examples and dealing with questions and dealing with study, because we're all busy, we all have busy lives. But, you know, these are all things that we struggle with. But I just bring them to your attention because I hope that it encourages you to really examine yourself and see the weight of what we're talking about. Because again, we are wearing the name of God. And time doesn't permit me, I forgot to mention this earlier, time doesn't permit me to talk about the whole New Testament concept that the church is the dwelling place of God. And so if some unbeliever wants to come to God in his dwelling place, he should have no farther to go than to look at God's people. And if we're hindering that, and we're causing someone to not really be interested in Christianity because of maybe these reasons or something else, it's a serious offense. Serious offense. I know next week, all of you are excited because Shane will be here. I know Shane will be a great encouragement to you in these areas, and he'll be a tremendous asset to this congregation in your pursuit of knowledge and in your Bible study. But brethren, let's never forget that these three things, this is all of our responsibility here. It's not going to be Shane's job to make sure that you have the proper level of Bible study that you can achieve. That's all on us. I mean, all of us are going to be responsible for these things in our jobs. So I know Shane will be of great aid to you, but he will be just that, an aid, not a replacement for the responsibility that we all bear in carrying the name of God to our peers. If you're not a Christian, you don't carry the name of Christ. It is only those who have been buried with him in baptism and raised up to be a new creature. It is only those that can claim to be true disciples of Jesus Christ. And if you've been baptized, and maybe you haven't been living in a way that really has made you a good instrument in spreading the gospel. Maybe you've hindered the gospel because you realize you haven't been living righteously, or you've been staying silent, or whatever the case may be. The great thing about Jesus Christ is he always gives us a chance to start over, to start fresh and start anew, because he's died for us to give us the reality that repentance is possible and is a tremendous gift that he's given to us. And if you have any need to take advantage of it today, one of the elders can meet you as you come forward. And so we'll ask you to do that now as we stand and sing.